Hey folks, Rob Wolf here, Greg Everett. What is this? Episode 138 of the Paleo Solution Podcast?
You bet.
Dude, cool. We were supposed to have Dr. Joe Brasco on, but we had some sort of a problem with the interwebs or something, and Dr. Joe never really picked up his line on the Skype dealio.
He probably just had some time to think about his involvement with the show and think better of it.
And he's gone completely dark. That's actually probably a good idea because he is a very smart guy. So he probably actually did some background checking on us and was like, yeah, I'll take a pass on that. So,
Oh, come on.
If that is not the case, then we will get Dr. Joe on here soon. We've got Mark Bell in queue, Nate Miyake. Who else? We've got a doc who is... what the heck is her name? Dr. Allison Seibecker, who's going to be on. She's a SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth expert, but she still looks pretty cute. So, despite her line of work. So, yeah, we've got some.
Hey, at least it's not podiatry or urology.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
So what's going on? How's the book is out? It's chugging along. If folks need to buy it, they need to read it. They need to post reviews on Amazon.
Yes, that is a big help. So far we've gotten some good reviews on there. So we really appreciate those of you who took the time to do it. We would really appreciate more and more of that stuff.
Cool.
And to answer your question before you even ask it, no, right now there is not a plan to release it as a Kindle version. Because I still have a soul.
Well, if people would just buy a bunch of your first book, then you could be independently wealthy and then you could give away the second book.
I know. It's so weird. I wrote a book on Olympic weightlifting and it didn't even hit the bestseller list. It seems like such a large market, high demand topic. Bizarre.
You need to do a Bulgarian translation and then maybe you'll get some mileage with that.
There you go. Cool. Well, what's going on with you? Getting more sleep?
A little bit more sleep. I can't say that it's really helping at all, but I think I'm sleeping a little more, but I feel even worse. But
got a large debt to pay at this point.
Yeah, I have a big debt to pay. And then I started talking to Nikki's dad about redoing our backyard because it's a disaster. And so he's like completely Mr. Fix-It, can build a house from scratch. I could do none of that, so basically I've been doing grunt labor type things, and I shoveled like 5 yards of dirt the other day, and dude, it was a kick to the jimmy.
Worse than virtual shoveling?
It was, in fact, worse than virtual shoveling. I was out in the sun, and I worked on my tan a little bit, but dude, that was an ass kicker.
Did you do 100 glute ham bench sit-ups right before you did your real-life shoveling?
Yes.
Just to make sure your back was extra stable?
Completely. I did a glute ham sit-ups until like my abdominal fibers were shredded apart and there was no possibility of like anterior stability coming from anything.
You need to make sure that you don't do anything that requires back strength until you have full scrotal edema. And then you know you're prepared.
Well, that's good to know.
I feel sorry for everyone who listens to this show who has no idea what we're talking about 90% of the time.
Wow.
You'll just have to believe me that it's funny.
We only know what we're talking about 80% of the time, so
it's consistent.
Yeah. That's a generous estimate. All right. Well, should we get on with this and prove how little we know?
Yes.
All right.
Let's do that.
Let's indeed do that. I like this subject line. Nobody ever says, wow, you carry a lot of tension in your abs, or why don't dogs need massages? Martine says, there's something suspiciously Neolithic about massage therapy. Why do I live and die by when my last deep tissue massage was? I've minimized sitting and get good sleep on a firm mattress. Maybe I have farther to go than I think, reducing stress in general. And why is it everyone's back? Maybe structured repetitive workouts are to blame. More play and helping load moving vans. I always thought piano movers had the most primal occupations from all those Paleolithic grand pianos.
Totally. But I mean, they make all of it. It's not just ivory, but they make the actual case out of like stone.
I was going to say, so didn't they have really some kind of piano or organ in the Flintstones? It's totally. Made of dinosaur bones or something.
Yeah, and I think they had like a mammoth that blew its, you know, nostril into it to power the whole thing.
That was based on a true story, right?
Yes.
By the way, have you seen the ads for this Abraham Lincoln vampire slayer, vampire killer movie?
It looks completely badass.
Dude, but here's my concern. The kids who are coming out of high school in this country right now are already stupid. I'm just going to say it plainly. And I mean, like, I'm not even joking when I say that I can guarantee you that a large percentage of our future high school graduates are going to sincerely believe that Abraham Lincoln fought vampires prior to his presidency.
Yeah, I could see that happening. I mean, you know, instead of, you know, uniting the Union, fighting the Civil War, all that stuff, then he's a vampire.
I heard something about like an exit exam of, I think it was Stanford graduates and another fairly reputable college. And something like 80% of them couldn't place the American Civil War within a 50-year period.
Oh.
I mean, but they knew, they all knew, you know, Britney Spears trivia and stuff. We're all going to die.
Well, you know, I can't, this is completely diversionary, obviously.
Yeah, stay on topic, Rob. Come on.
The other day, I forget what the thing was, but I was just kind of like, you know what? Maybe it's better we don't get off this rock. Like, maybe we should stay here until the sun expands out to, you know, 3/4 of the you know, the orbit of Mars, and Mars becomes balmy again, and we just get recycled. And maybe it's better we just... Oh, yeah, I remember the topic, and I'm actually not going to go into it because it'll people will come and kill me before the sun expands and consumes everything. So, yeah, I don't know, man. It's I'm reading this book, Wool. Sorry, guys, I'm exhausted, and
I'm just normal.
We're just jabbering, and so Chris Kresser told me about this sci-fi novel, Wool, which is really interesting, kind of dystopic.
Wait, wool as in the stuff that comes off a sheep's back?
It is, but it's got a different significance in this thing. But it's this classic scenario of like kind of an authoritarian state, and it's just really interesting because on the one hand you have this authoritarian kind of gig where it's like, you know, people are either lazy or dumb or, you know, whatever. So you need somebody that's in control and like, you know, shoehorning people into stuff, or you have this more free, lackadaisical gig, but then you start getting stuff like, you know, Snooki being an authority on anything, you know, like parenting now and stuff like that. And
God.
It's just a weird deal. Like, it's legitimately a really weird deal. Like, if you allow people the ability to just, you know, be free and think on their own and everything, like some good stuff comes out of it, but then some really ridiculous shit comes out of it too. But
what is it? Mr. Stephen Pan the other day was telling me something that he read. It was like just kind of reiterating the fact that the internet is 99% of the people are reading 1% of the people's content, something to that effect. Okay. Well, so why don't dogs need massages, Rob?
You know, I've seen a number of dog massage therapists around, and they seem to do pretty well. So maybe hounds do need massages.
Yeah. Okay. So
to some degree, I think this goes into a little bit of a deeper deal where. And you know, I was just talking about people being crazy and we shouldn't get off the planet. And here I'm going to lead into one of these prime things that causes people to incite craziness. I'm going to bring up the evolution topic. And when you look at the structure of our pelvis, our pelvi, collective pelvises, it's a work in progress, and it's not, when you look at the low back and you look at kind of the structures of the pelvis and everything, like it's a compromise between, you know, particularly on the female side, being able to birth children. We had an interesting conversation on the paleo science list or something like that, which was basically that like hunter-gatherer brains, you know, were bigger and the head size was bigger and the pelvis was larger in the females then, and all that stuff has gotten smaller. And one of the docs on the list made the analogy that for the hunter-gatherer, that you're basically talking about like a Ferrari. Like, you're talking about the kind of the, you know, big, strong, smart, the kind of the epitome of the species, and also really low output. It's kind of like an artisan kind of deal, whereas when you've got an agricultural scenario, you're pumping babies out like crazy, and so you need smaller heads, a little bit of a compromise on the birth canal because of some of the demands associated with like agricultural work and all this stuff, and it was just kind of an interesting gig. But you know, we have this the low back issues are pretty common, you know, just in general. And then the more kind of westernized, the more we sit in chairs, the more that we're not squatting all the time and stuff like that, the more that these back problems ensue, and you get tight hip flexors, you can get tight hamstrings, weird loading parameters and stuff like that. It's just kind of endemic in the thing. And I think that part of this question, you know, like the whole massage deal, that's, I'm trying to collect my thoughts here. You know, so you've got this naturalistic world where we just live under bushes and we scratch around and we do whatever we're doing. And then you start getting this understanding of how the world works, and, or maybe you don't even understand necessarily how it works, but some empirical findings, which, you know, like your low back hurts. If you have somebody rub it, it doesn't hurt so bad. And this is kind of the beginning of medicine. You know, in this case, I would put massage under the physical medicine category and add orthopedic adjustments, chiropractic, you know, DO, osteopathic adjustments and stuff like that, you know, going all the way down to like, you know, taking a broken limb and being able to extract it and reset the bone and stuff like that. So a bunch of this stuff maybe isn't necessarily naturalistic, but as we start developing technology and understanding the world, and even just an empirical observation, like, okay, my low back hurts if I have somebody stick their elbow in it and kind of wiggle the elbow around, it makes it feel better. And then when we start doing tissue histology and stuff like that, we realize that it releases cytokines and maybe breaks up calcifications. Another thought on this, which I know this is probably the last show that people ever listen to. It's like the most rambling bunch of rambletude ever. But I think actually abdominal massage is really, really beneficial for digestion. A lot of people end up having adhesions and scar tissue from falls. They can get adhesions with the diaphragm so that the inhalation, exhalation doesn't really work that well. So I think I'm a big fan of massage, actually. And yeah, it is pretty Neolithic, but it's...
So it's the computer you use to send that email.
Yeah, totally. And this is where, you know, getting too geeked out on historical revisionism, I think is problematic. You know, use it for a guide. And I know that Martine was you know, being tongue in cheek on this whole gig, but I think, you know, back problems are related to structural compromises that have evolved in the low back and the pelvis to allow us to be effective at that whole hunting gathering kind of gig. And I think that to the degree that we stay more mobile, that we tend to squat more versus sitting in chairs and stuff like that, I think that we tend to minimize problems with that. I think we talked about like the ileocecal valve on previous podcasts. For a long, long time, there was this, you can dig it up in old medical journals, where people would say, wow, isn't it odd that we were so poorly designed, that we were so poorly created, that feces kind of backflows from lower in the GI tract to higher up in the GI tract, and you get dysbiosis and problems. And the reason being is that when people sit on kind of a elevated toilet, you don't create the intra-abdominal pressure that pushes the ileocecal valve down. And so when you relieve yourself, everything goes one direction. It goes downward. And it was a simple deal of, like, if you just have people squat to relieve themselves, then this problem is solved. And I've actually, the dudes that made the squatty potty thing sent me one of their testers, and I use it dutifully every day. I have some design recommendations for those guys because the thing is a little bit shaky, and I've almost taken a dive off of it a time or two. But, you know, there's just stuff like that where I think if you can use some of this kind of evolutionary template and overlay it, then we can answer some questions. But then we certainly want to take all that we know out of medicine and science and all that, and then try to optimize these two things. And I'm sure that went so far afield from what Martine originally meant that she may just like run and leap out the window when she hears this response. But that's what I've got.
That was fantastic, Rob. Don't beat yourself
up. Thank you. You're very accommodating.
No, I think that, you kind of made these points somewhere in there. But, I think you have to recognize the fact that no matter how much you try, you are not going to be able to perfectly replicate a Paleolithic life, especially with regard to the types and degrees of stressors. There's just no way. And so I think you have to understand that, a lot of people kind of carry their stress, so to speak, in their lower backs. Not everyone, though. I mean, I know plenty of people, it's all neck problems.
Yeah.
GI problems. I tend to be a lower back person myself, too, but that's probably just because I'm a little chubby.
I like big boned, and you just look just fine there.
There you go. So, thanks. Yeah. I'm just trying to be myself. And now I'm totally off track. I guess my point was that, you have to understand that you can't totally replicate the Paleolithic lifestyle. And so you're going to have to accept some of these kind of side effects of, this more Neolithic nature of stress in terms of kind of these more chronic low-level stressors rather than these more kind of punctuated, acute stressors. And it's going to affect you a lot differently. And so you may have to make up the difference with Neolithic practices such as massage therapy or, sitting in the hot tub with your champagne, whatever the case may be, possibly both together.
Dude, I want to bypass the champagne and start growing opium poppies in my backyard and just chew on those.
There you go.
Go right to the opium
receptor. Hey, you have the perfect chance. You're digging up your backyard right now. You just need nothing but coca plants and some good old poppies.
I think Reno is more along the lines of Afghanistan, so I think I'm more likely to be able to pull off the opium poppies. So,
it's worth a shot either way.
Yeah. So, Martine, good question, horrible answer. That's about as good as it's going to get today, though. And that's on my cup of coffee and my nicotine gum. So that's as good as it's going
to
get.
Cool. All right, well, let's move on to plantar fasciitis.
Cool.
Ben says, hi, guys. Straight to it. I'm a professional rugby player in New Zealand, have been for 8 years. Last couple of seasons, I've had problems with plantar fasciitis when playing on hard grounds, and so the medical staff prescribed me orthotics specially designed for me. In the 4 weeks I've been using the orthotics, my sacrum joint blocked up 1 week, got a killer bout of osteitis pubis the next week, never had it before, but it seemed to clear up my plantar fasciitis and also cleared up my pinch I have in my hip joint from a labrum tear a few years back and takes pressure off my old turf toe injury. Maybe the orthotics have aligned me, quote, perfectly. However, I've gone my whole life being imperfect as my left leg is slightly shorter than my right. Are these orthotics the cause in throwing me completely out of kilter? Or do I persevere and will my body adjust to them over time? P.S. My wife is threatening to divorce me if I scratch my balls one more time when in public with her. She says I'm itchy from the gluten and grains I eat. This is probably a question for another day. Thanks so much, Ben. So I just want to interject here real quick. And people every once in a while post questions. Why is your podcast listed as explicit on iTunes and this and that? And I just want to say it's not entirely our fault.
We created the culture, though. We have created the culture. I mean, if we weren't the way we were, people would not write in telling us that their balls are itchy.
I don't know. I don't know. I'm not ready to assume the entirety of the
blame responsibility.
Yet.
Yeah.
Well,
but yeah. So it well, it, you know, I just the end there, the fact that you are still eating gluten and grains. I remember Josh Everett had a wicked case of plantar fasciitis. Like it seemed like he had it for like 2 years, and then I would just like beg the dude, just try eating better paleo because he ate pretty well, and you know he's a big strong dude and all that. But if I remember correctly, like the plantar fasciitis cleared out within days of pulling the gluten out of the mix. So I mean, it anytime we've got any type of itis, you know, an inflammation of something. We've got some heat going on. We've got inflammation. And it just, I just can't make a strong enough argument for you know, again, like a 30-day intervention, particularly during the season, to go as tight paleo, gluten-free paleo as you could. Make sure your vitamin D levels are good. Like, that's just the gimme. And the orthotics aside, so many of these problems, whether it's plantar fasciitis, patellar tendonitis, IT band syndrome, carpal tunnel, I mean, all of this stuff, if you do a little digging around in the literature, really high linkage with hyperinsulinism, with systemic inflammation. Correlation isn't causation, but it's goddamn compelling when you see it again and again and again. And it's a really simple thing to do to just give this a shot. And something to consider with this too, and if you have chronic inflammation in whatever, you know, chunk of tissue that you've got, you are laying down scar tissue in that area. You're compromising the long-term integrity of that tissue, and the likelihood of having some sort of a catastrophic injury down the road is much greater. So, I mean, it really behooves one to address these issues both orthopedically and you know, nutritionally and lifestyle wise and stuff like that. I mean, rugby obviously is pretty rough on the body. This dude sounds like he, you know, was strapped to the outside of a car during a destruction derby or something. So it's got some pretty good mileage. But as to the orthotics, like this is definitely not my strong area of it's a bit outside my wheelhouse. I'm okay on the orthopedic side of stuff, but not spectacular. This could be a situation where your body is going to adapt to this new positioning. The fact that you've got one leg shorter than the other, that always seems to benefit from some sort of shimming to equalize that so that we minimize that, you know, kind of bilateral stress on the pelvis and everything else that goes on from that. But whether or not you're going to eventually get to a spot where things normalize and your body is happy from the feet upward because of the orthotics, I really don't know. Like I know some people are super geeked on orthotics. Other people are a little bit more sanguine about their usage. So I really don't know. Greg, you've done some tinkering with this stuff and worked with some people that do orthotics more. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's definitely to be expected that you're going to have some discomfort and some achiness and whatnot, especially in the knees and hips, sometimes lower back and everything, when you first start using orthotics. That's pretty much a given. It sounds like your reaction to it was a little more extreme. And so, you know, like Rob said, it's I don't know that there's really a way to predict whether or not all that stuff is going to kind of clear itself up eventually, and you should stick with it. I would say, though, I feel like this is an old question. I think I've seen it before and we had to skip it. So hopefully this is even useful at this point. But I would say try to stick it out because it sounds like the reactions you are getting to them are acute and temporary and you've kind of cleared them up and that it has cleared up the chronic problems you were having trouble with. So to me, that seems like you're coming out with a net benefit. That being said, I used to work with a physical therapist down when we were in Southern California who made a good point to me at one point. He's like, you know, a lot of these therapists are looking to kind of rebuild these people's bodies perfectly. Like, that's their goal, is to get everything aligned perfectly and have it, you know, kind of fresh out of the box sort of setup. And he's like, you know, I think it's a real mistake because people are not built perfectly by nature. And, you know, you're going to have these little disparities side to side, front to back, whatever. And he said, you know, the goal should be to try to make everything function optimally within those parameters rather than trying to, you know, rebuild a person in a manner that they aren't meant to be built. And so it's like you have to try to correct this stuff to a degree, but not exceed that degree and try to correct things that are not going to be helpful, you know, once you try to fix them. So I would ride it out for a little bit and just pay real close attention to the other issues you have. And hopefully by now, since this question is probably like 10 years old, all the problems have gone away. And yeah. Maybe it even cleared up your jock itch. Who knows?
or you're a little bit more tactical about addressing the jock itch. So yeah, what do you feel like is a good timeline that you would give this thing? And you know, one thought also, and this is kind of going back to our question one. It seems like this is a great spot to get in and start doing a ton of foam rolling. Maybe track down a really good body worker doing some rolfing. Like this is the time to do like some earlobe to toenail kind of structural integration type stuff to try goose things along to get dialed back in. And doing this during season may not be the best time to do this too.
Yeah. And that's a good point. Doing it while you're playing games is probably poor timing. It definitely seems like a good off season sort of thing. So you can do, like Rob said, you know, do the structural work, try to kind of shore everything up with the orthotics, you know, kind of rewire the movement patterns and whatnot. And it's like, you know, if I had a lifter in here who I thought needed orthotics, I wouldn't have them put them in 2 weeks before a big meet. You know, it'd be right after a meet, for example, where we're just starting a new cycle and we have a ways to go so we can kind of see how things go and ride out whatever problems there may be. But again, that's can't necessarily do that. It sounds like he's already a bit through the process. So in terms of how long I would give it, I don't know. I mean, he said he's already been doing it for 4 weeks. So to me, that's a pretty good amount of time. Like I would say that's probably a good shot. And I mean, in that time he says it cleared up the fasciitis and helped the hip out. And so aside from that, the two other new problems, it sounds like it's kind of working. So if those other problems have just kind of popped up once and then never reappeared, then I think you're definitely good to go. If they continue to pop up every single week or something like that, then obviously you need to look into a different kind of correction. Maybe some like less intense orthotic shape.
Right. The only thing like this that I've ever had was when I really was trying to give Olympic weightlifting a go. And to do that effectively, obviously you got to wear some shoes, O-lifting shoes. And it would start... Which is totally not paleo. But that upright torso, the catch position is so critical for being successful with that. And it would, every single time I would get to a spot where I had such knee pain and then like just distal to my patella, like just felt like the periosteum on my tibia was just going to like rip off at some point. And I suspect that it was always a deal where like if I lowered the loading, did way more foam rolling and stretching and stuff like that I could have probably got through the thing, but I'm both busy enough and lazy enough that, you know, my general body maintenance is pretty good. I've generally got good mobility, can do most things really well and not with pain. But this was one of these things that I just never could quite get over the hump with it and wasn't willing to put in the time to make it go, which kind of sucks because I really like the lifts. And so I just kind of have to tinker with the power variance now. But I still think that if I had given my body more time, lowered the loading, really, really got aggressive on the kind of, you know, body reintegration gig, I could have probably got over the hump and been able to O-lift more effectively.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's enough on that one, I would say.
Indeed.
Did we give a good enough answer?
or a bad enough one or the other.
Okay, Luke says, background, several outfits are offering various flavors of blood work, LabCorp, Quest, Wellness, FX, etc. Question number one, what is, quote, the list of blood/urine tests to get done before, during, and after a paleo challenge? Question number two, what is your estimate of the cost of such a blood/urine workup? Question number three, from a regional perspective, where would such a blood/urine workup be most/least expensive? In other words, instead of getting it done in Silicon Valley, have it done in Reno during a previously scheduled Sierra weekend.
Everything's cheaper in Nevada. So this is
although good. All those Quest and LabCorp, I mean, they're all a single company, so their prices, I imagine, are the same because they're all billing insurance for the most part.
Yeah. Interesting deal. I just had dinner with the folks who are the specialty health folks that are doing the risk assessment deal here in Reno. And then we also had one of the reps from LipoScience, which is a really high-end advanced testing kind of – it's the advanced testing that we use on the police and firefighters when they go through the basic risk assessment – that we offer, which is totally standard blood work, like total cholesterol, triglycerides, blood glucose, fasting insulin, CBC with a differential and all that jive. If somebody ends up flagging that thing like they have super high LDL levels, then we end up doing some advanced testing on them. High LDL levels and or super high triglycerides, like basically if they're showing some sort of an insulin-resistant profile – then we kick it over to an advanced test. And in the advanced test, I posted some videos on this, but I should probably just do a blog post on blood work and kind of the, you know, how my perspective has kind of evolved on this stuff. What typically happens when we are looking at the standard intervention, when we look at like HDL, LDL, total cholesterol, you've got these lipoproteins, high-density lipoprotein, HDL, low-density lipoprotein, LDL, and then VLDLs and intermediate and all that jive. But you've got a particle that is mixed up of this protein fraction that helps to move cholesterol through the body because cholesterol is a fat-soluble, it's a lipid-soluble item. And it kind of needs a protein chaperone to be able to move it through the aqueous medium of the body. And historically, what we've looked at is just the cholesterol fraction of these particles. And Dr. Tara Dahl of the National Lipid Association, she is a brilliant woman and incredibly easy on the eyes also. We're going to have her on the podcast. We may need to make that one a video podcast because she's just beautiful woman, really smart, super cool. But she makes this point that you need to think about this, that the problem is not the passenger, the cholesterol, whether we're talking HDL or LDL, but it's the cars. It's the actual particles themselves. And part of what starts going south in, say, like an insulin-resistant situation and a hypothyroid situation is that we tend to start shifting the LDL particles from large and puffy to smaller. And typically what happens with the small, dense stuff, they have a higher likelihood of interacting with the intimal media of the vascular bed. It's just kind of a statistics thing. If you've got more and more of these things peppering around on the inside of the arterial wall, the vascular wall, you've got a higher likelihood for some sort of a problem to happen. And it's kind of interesting. Usually what happens is that you've got a given amount of cholesterol that's circulating through your body. We'll just say like 100 milliliters of say, like low-density cholesterol. If you have large particles, each one of those particles can carry a relatively larger amount of cholesterol. So that 100 milliliters of cholesterol gets carried by fewer particles. Those particles tend to interact more favorably with the interior of the vascular lining, and so things are better. If they are smaller, then you've got way more little, you know, carrier units moving the stuff around, and they tend not to interact with the LDL receptor sites as well in our tissues, and we tend to have higher likelihood of problems. So the additional work, like you're still going to be kind of, unless you want to really, really throw down some pretty serious money, you're still basically going to be doing your basic profile, like, you know, total cholesterol, HDL, LDL, triglycerides. I would really recommend that people do vitamin D. It's a little bit of an add-on. It's like a $20 add-on, something like that. If you can throw in some hormones appropriate for your situation, if you're a male, like total and free testosterone, sex hormone binding protein, and stuff like that. Females, that plus estrogen. I think almost everybody should probably be getting their thyroids checked. TSH, you know, kind of a full thyroid panel. But when you're talking about that basic total cholesterol, vitamin D, CBC with DIF, you're probably talking $100, maybe $125. When you start throwing on each one of these additional pieces, like you want a full thyroid panel, that might double the cost of the thing. So you're talking like $300 or something. So it just kind of depends on what type of money you want to throw out there, and you know, what type of risk analysis you're doing. If you've had long-standing cardiovascular disease in your family, like both of my parents had heart disease pretty much, you know, from their like 30s on. So I've actually taken a little bit more of an interest in tracking my stuff, and my stuff's been going great. The numbers look good, so I'm kind of stoked, but I'm still a little bit more interested in tracking that stuff just curiosity's sake, and kind of validating that what I'm doing is working. But this advanced testing, like adding in LP little A, which is a really inflammatory kind of biomarker or lipid marker, that's one that's definitely worth tracking. Doing the full NMR analysis of your particles will give a total count. It'll give sizes. That stuff starts getting pricey. Like you start getting potentially up in the $400 to $600 range to do that whole package. But backing up to when we first launched into this next train wreck of an answer, we are trying to put together through the specialty health folks. If all this stuff comes to pass, we will have a contract with LabCorp and with LipoScience. LabCorp is just kind of like a big meat and potatoes. You know, they do all the bulk testing. They do hormone testing. They can do intestinal permeability testing and stuff like that. But we'll be doing work with those guys and with LipoScience to do initial screening and then advanced testing on the people that are appropriate for that. Folks will be able to buy that through the website, and they'll be able to order this stuff direct. And because we've got more than six people listening to the podcast now, a few more. And if the numbers are there, then this stuff should be really inexpensive compared to going to your doc in the box and ordering this stuff through LabCorp and just getting hammered with the standard markup on that stuff. So we should, hopefully by the end of the summer, have some sort of a specialty health Rob Wolf combo deal where you can order blood work, you are sent the results. Those results are pumped to Specialty Health, which they are a health management organization, and they've got like 1.5 million people in their database. And then you will have a doctor that you can kind of interface with, and it will just you know that individual can give you some guidance about like, hey, you look like you're going to live to be, you know, older than like George Burns or whatever, or
is he still alive?
You should, yeah, I think he is actually. He's still smoking cigars and chasing chicks.
What a badass.
It totally. Or if you need to, it would be recommended you should probably get some advanced testing, and you should follow up with a doctor. And then the cool thing is that the physicians network is getting large enough that we're getting close to having somebody within spitting distance of most folks. And then we have the certification that's rolling out, and we're going to do some work with the specialty health folks so that people are savvy about these practitioners are savvy about how to order tests, how to interpret these tests. We're going to have Teradol doing some work with them through the National Lipid Association. So I'm hoping that in like 4 months, 5 months at the outside, we'll have at least the beginnings of this a direct-to-consumer kind of opportunity for folks to order blood work and have it at a lot lower price. And I think more importantly than that, like I like the Wellness FX folks, but if you do a little poking around on those guys, they've got like 400 or 500 people total in their database. The specialty health people, they've been in business since I think 91, and they have over 1.5 million people in their database. So when we start talking about the ability to do some really robust statistical analysis and do some risk predictions, risk forecasting, I think they've got a really solid database on that stuff. So anyway, it wasn't my intention to turn this into an infomercial for this thing, but just to let folks know that that's kind of what's cooking. And in the meantime, you can do some shopping around between LabCorp, Quest, all these other folks, but the prices are kind of fixed because you're dealing with a relatively low volume of people interacting with these folks. And I think it's reasonable to start on the very conservative side of this stuff. Do a very basic CBC with differential and your basic total cholesterol, kind of gig. And if you see something that pops up that's kind of concerning, like you've got some pretty high total cholesterol, you've got some really high LDL and low HDL and stuff like that, bad triglycerides, then we can do some advanced testing and do some more investigating in that line.
Sweet.
Cool.
Fantastic advice there, Rob.
Okay. I just made it all up. There's nothing factual about any of it. So
that's okay. Brad says, I've been on a fairly strict paleo diet since April of 2011 with maybe 1 to 2 cheat meals per week with some period of challenge with no cheats. I noticed a sudden onset of hair loss once starting the diet and has continued progressively over the past year. Before paleo, I had no hair loss. I'm curious to know what may have caused this. Is there a lack of vitamins/minerals in my diet? Is it a high level of protein causing the hair loss? Is it possible a change in diet would inhibit regrowth of any lost hair? Also, are there specific foods that I should be including in my diet that may help in this? You're also 1 to 2 years older than you were when you started. It's kind of like when people start shaving and they say that shaving makes their beard grow. But it's just because you didn't have... You just started shaving when you started going through puberty.
Details.
I don't know, Rob. Is there more to it?
Pieces. The one thing that kind of pops up on this stuff that I think people could be a little deficient on in a basic paleo shtick is iodine. I think reasonably easy to end up iodine deficient because folks are typically limiting salt and maybe iodine. Standard iodized salt. They're not eating a lot of sea vegetables. They're not eating a ton of seafood. So it's a possibility. And this is something that, doing a basic thyroid panel and testosterone and all that stuff could ferret things out. It still is this thing though. Like if you just went back, how are we usually, well, to answer one of these questions, is a high protein intake going to stimulate hair loss? I really don't think so. Like the things that we know for sure in the literature, alopecia, like male pattern baldness type stuff, really heavily correlated with elevated insulin levels. And this is something that we've seen out of like the comparisons of traditional Japanese diet versus when Japanese people moved to the United States or different westernized areas. And then, you start seeing male pattern baldness. And there's a big piece to it that is insulin-mediated, causing basically the death or the damage of the hair follicles. And there's some testosterone interplay with that stuff. There's also some autoimmune alopecia. I don't want to just be like the complete diehard paleo champion, but it's one of these things where if generally what we're talking about is swapping out like bread and rice and pasta and eating fruits, vegetables, roots and tubers. And, like protein, carb, fat is approximately the same, or maybe there's a little tweak on the ratios, but not, it doesn't really make sense that that's going to be the issue, but by all means, you could go back and eat the other way that you were eating previously and see if it rectifies things, but it doesn't really make much sense to me. Vitamin D levels.
But if we're talking about male pattern baldness, I mean, isn't that just one of these things that you're going to have to accept and just shave your head and just go go like Michael Rutherford style and just be dead sexy with that bald pate?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Like, my gut sense on this stuff is that a lot of this is driven by insulin. But if we're, you know, if you transition to a lower insulin load diet and then that's when it starts, that's where it gets murky. Like,
what if his testosterone levels suddenly shot up like 500%? It seems unlikely.
You can get some, that's the whole like testosterone to DHT, dihydrotestosterone conversion, and that is one of the factors that is involved in basic hair loss. You know,
all your hair leaves your head and goes to your back.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, you see this a lot in anabolic, you know, steroid use. You get kind of a similar effect out of that. I don't know. Like, it's hard for me to hang this thing on better eating. And again, the main spot that I would suspect might be going on is that there could be potentially a little bit of low thyroid, potentially some some iodine deficiency. But beyond that, I just can't think of a mechanism that would really drive that thing. When we know that autoimmunity and insulin are kind of the main drivers, and yeah, I mean, maybe he's still, because of a wacky work schedule or low vitamin D, he went paleo, testosterone went up, conversion into DHT was higher than what we would like, and that's what's driving this thing. And I guess that's where you could do some blood work and look at testosterone and thyroid and all the rest of that and try to ferret some of that stuff out. But it's it's hard for me to hang it on this. Like, I don't want to be the total paleo knob polisher on this thing, but it's just hard to imagine that going towards foods that are less inflammatory, less likely to cause autoimmunity, less likely to promote insulin problems, that is going to be the issue.
All right. Okay, finally we have a long question again. And it's going to get explicit, so... Okay, exercise for weight loss. Warhammer says, "Hi guys, big fan of the blog, blah blah, like everyone says. Let's get to the bidness. I'm 6'4", 325 pounds, gray blue eyes, Taurus." All right. "After following the Neolithic grad student functional alcoholic diet, on shelf soon, already on Kindle, I'm in serious need of this paleo solution. I read the book, super psyched about it. Can't believe the cultural norms we carry about food, zeal of the new convert, etc. I'm working toward my 30 days of total compliance and feeling great. I literally shit diamonds yesterday. Ahem. I have read in your blog that you are not a fan of exercise for weight loss. See," and then link to that particular blog post. "It seemed that you were mostly concerned with exercise-centric approaches. Anyhow, nowhere in your blog or podcast do I see a theoretical or practical approach to the role of exercise and weight loss. It was referenced a bit in the book, but not much. You mentioned helping Nathan get his Brad Pitt abs in a podcast. But what do you recommend for someone who wants to lose a considerable amount of fat, say in my case, 80 pounds? I can't believe that you would be anti-exercise for promoting weight loss considering your ass owns a gym. But maybe you just like being around sweaty people. That's cool. It takes all kinds. You seem to get a little pissed at people who want to, quote, lose weight." And then he links to another blog post. "You tell them to pick a performance goal and stop talking about the scale. I think this is inconsistent because when people have asked about how to look like Brad Pitt, you've not balked about giving advice on how to get them from slim to sub 10% body fat. So why don't you throw the fatties a frickin' bone here and talk about how best to work out to promote fat loss over a longer haul? And if you need a performance goal, then it is to go tantric in the sack with a supermodel. There. Now get me in the gym under 10% body fat to increase the chances of this occurring. P.S. I fucking know how to sleep already. You have drilled that into me, so if you tell me to sleep, I'm going to go fetal and cry. All ribbing aside, I'm so thankful to you, and I'm just really hoping to get your opinion here. All the best to you and the new babe."
Wow, that's a lot.
Man, that Warhammer moniker there is pretty appropriate for a number of reasons.
I think Warhammer should take over the podcast. I think we've been outclassed here. You know, a lot of it. So the first link here, exercise and effective for weight loss.
this is just some of the stuff that floats around the research where, you know,
they'll start, and Gary Tobbs talks about this a ton in his books, where people will start exercising, and when they exercise, then their appetite increases, and they tend to match food intake to pretty closely meet energy expenditure, and so the, you know, the fat loss, weight loss deal is kind of problematic. My main thing is just that, and because my ass does own a gym, we get people constantly through the door who just feel like if they go another 30 miles, and God, the fucking cyclists are the worst on this, you know, where if I spend another hour, if I do the fast 40 and you know, I still can't figure out why I've got a gut, but they'll do this ride around Chico and then pull in the Sierra Nevada and have a bunch of beer and you know, some really good food.
Oh, great, man, they have the beer sampler there. It's like 16 different types of beer all in a tray. Not that I'm recommending that, of course.
And it's absolutely delicious. It would give me the trots for a month. But, you know, we just consistently see these folks that think that exercise is going to be the solution here. And there's just this point where bad diet cock blocks any efforts that you have at exercise. And you start getting in this hyperinsulinemic kind of merry-go-round where you're eating bad food. And when we start getting into that, and I know that, you know, I'm going to get hammered here because the insulin spiking.
You're going to get war-hammered, Rob.
I'm going to get war-hammered. You know, does insulin spiking cause insulin resistance? Maybe, maybe not. Yes, no. It's food palatability. Fuck, whatever. You know, you get so far down the rabbit hole on this stuff trying to figure out the mechanism that I think you lose the ability to actually help people. But the reality is that this bad food seems to set up either some sort of an insulinogenic event or a systemic inflammatory event, and we start heading down this road where we start getting into blood sugar highs and lows. When we dip into the lows, we release cortisol. When we release cortisol, blood sugar goes up. We start, even though blood sugar may actually legitimately be kind of high, but the sensing between the brain and the liver is off. And we start getting into that kind of merry-go-round. I talk about it a ton in the book. That gets us into a gluconeogenic state where we start tearing down muscle mass to generate sugar load for what is either legitimately or perceived to be low blood sugar. And so this is the problem that I see on the exercise side. There are a lot of people that assume that they can just keep exercising harder and they will burn off the shitty food that they eat, and that just doesn't happen. And now for the people that really want to lose weight, and this pops up on my Twitter feed all the damn time, the person is like hand-wringing, oh, I've been eating paleo, but I, you know, I've only lost 2 pounds and I don't know what to do, and the person starts spinning out. And this is why I focus people on a performance goal. Because a lot of times these people are not eating enough then, they're not eating enough protein. And if with that performance goal, you've kind of got that thing that distracts you from sitting there thinking about your weight every day, all the time, and every time you cruise through your bathroom, like jumping on the scale, and because you weren't sweating a lot today or maybe didn't have as big a bowel movement as you did yesterday, then the person spins out and they start doing stupid stuff. And so the performance orientation I just have found to be really effective for shutting people up long enough to eat well enough to be able to affect some type of change. And so that's why I make these recommendations. And I think if you find kind of your carb tolerance level and you go a little bit below that and you generally are eating a little bit of a calorie-restricted approach, and if you're eating higher protein and probably eating more fat and the carbs that you're eating are intelligent, then you should start dealing with some of that neuroregulation of appetite. And so you aren't as hungry when you start exercising and you've got a fighting chance of actually losing some weight. You probably are still going to be a little bit hungry, but not horrifically so. And so a lot of this is just kind of having one, you know, you've got a variety of people out there, a various variety of people, as Greg might say, and you need a little bit of a different script to be able to meet those people. And so for where you're at, I would go more on the low carb side. Maybe it doesn't have to be ketogenic, 30 grams of carbs a day, but probably under 100 grams of carbs. Eat a lot of protein, eat a lot of veggies, and get in and start doing some smart exercise. And I think you'll probably do really well with that. The protein is going to be very satiating. It's going to address that neuroregulation of appetite, and just be intelligent with the training that you do. I think like some moderate to high volume bodybuilding type stuff, so that you're both burning calories and you're building muscle, and then doing some interval type stuff, ranging from the real short end, Tabata type stuff, 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off, all the way up to like 3 to 5 minute more aerobic type intervals, just mixing all that up. This is where kind of a CrossFit-esque thing is really helpful, so long as the volume and the intensity is smart. You don't beat the dog piss out of yourself.
I think the thing to keep in mind too is that no one's really saying, or at least Rob is not saying, that exercise is going to have no effect on weight loss. That's really not the point. Yeah, it's going to help, but I think, like he has said there, that people get really hung up on the exercise side of things because, to be quite honest, that's the easy part. Anybody can go spend an hour in the gym a day. It's not a big deal, even though they bitch and moan about it. And when they do it, they brag about it as if it's some amazing accomplishment. But the nutrition side of it is so much more difficult. It requires so much more discipline because that's all day long, every single day. And in my opinion, it's way more difficult to stay disciplined with your nutrition than it is to force yourself into a gym or to do some kind of physical activity every single day for 30 to 60 minutes. And so I think it's kind of unfair to say, oh, well, you're saying exercise has nothing to do with weight loss. No, it's going to help. But I can point out plenty of examples in my own gym of people who are just not willing to put in the effort into their nutrition. And so they look the exact same day in, day out, even though they're in here consistently exercising and their strength numbers are going up, their performance is going up, but they're drinking beer every single night and they're eating like shit. Well, guess what? They're still going to be chubby, even though you might argue that they're more fit than they were when they started. Their body composition doesn't really change dramatically. And then we have right next to them training the guys who came in, bought into the nutrition part of it that we really don't push. We kind of say, hey, here's what we suggest. Either do it or don't. I'm not going to hold your hand. I'm sure as shit not going to babysit you through the process. If you want to do it and you want to make progress, here's how to do it. And those are the guys who not only are their performance numbers going up, but their body composition is going through dramatic changes. I mean, you're talking about losing, 50, 60 pounds and keeping it off, versus just kind of being the same as they were when they started. And so it's like you've got to take care of the whole thing. You've got to do it from stem to stern, not just pick the one thing that you like better or that is easier or that seems more reasonable to you. So I don't know. Maybe that was an angrier response than I intended it to be, but it's a little frustrating when you have people walking into the gym wearing a heart rate monitor and they do it all day long and you ask them, hey, why are you wearing that thing? I say, oh, well, so I can know how much I can eat today. It's like, oh, my God, you're going about this all wrong. It's like testing, looking at see how many calories you burnt on the treadmill so you know how many pieces of cake you can eat tomorrow. It just doesn't work that way. So that's my 2.5 cents on that whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess just keeping in mind that, it's always challenging when you've got a really mixed audience that you're playing to. If you do something where you just focus on like I'm going to do like the lean gains deal and just focus on people that want to do bodybuilding and figure stuff, you can really narrow your message and be very, very consistent with it. But I'm trying to reach a pretty broad audience here, people ranging from kind of high end performance all the way to although I got to say my kind of interest, I think the most important stuff that we're doing is more focused on like saving people's lives by just getting them to not be metabolically broken and maybe think about somato immune and systemic inflammatory stuff. But with that in mind, you need a variety of messages out there in because you have a enormous number of people that are at different places in their life and how they're approaching all this stuff. So I guess just kind of keeping that in mind too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we managed to stretch out five questions to an entire hour.
Wow, we rambled today.
No, we were just thorough.
Okay.
It's different. This thorough is much better than rambling.
I like that.
Cool. Well,
so anything else? Any parting bit that folks need to be aware of?
I don't think so. Okay. Just if you haven't checked out the new book already, go check that out, please. And if you loved it, you got it, please post a review on Amazon or, you know, on your blog or your Space Face or Twitter, you know, whatever it is you do to tell the world what you feel.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, man. Thanks. I'll try to have even more coffee and more stimulants on the next go around, or maybe my opium poppies will be in by then and I'll be all, you know, a flutter from that. So
excellent. I like it.
Cool. All right, G. Thanks, man.
Okay. See ya.
Okay. Bye.